We live in a society that is often fascinated with the miraculous. We fondly remember, thank you, Dr. Patrice, for setting this up, the miracle that was the Cubs in winning the World Series just a couple years ago. Well, how about we joyfully recall the miracle of Game 162 for the Rays just a few years before? At which point you're saying, why are you talking about baseball? Well, guess what? Tomorrow is February, and in February, spring training begins. Exactly. This is the kind of thing that I would suggest perhaps the stuff of legends as well as of movies. Ours is also a society which is drawn to the mystical and the mysterious. So Madonna has led an ever-growing parade of famous people who become enchanted with Kabbalah. And crowds of people flock to the various Marvel Universe movies, as it seems like we get a new one almost every month. And so appropriately, our text tonight begins, as you heard it read, Lema'an Shitioto Ta'ele Bekirbo. It's talking about, this was done so that I might place my signs, miracles, these ones, onto them. It's as if it's being imposed from outside onto them. But then it goes on to say, Ve'etototai asher samtivam. And in this case, it's a different verbiage. And it says, concerning these signs, they've been put among them. It's almost as if one is imposed from on high, the other sort of grows up from where they are at. So God has moved. And it reminds us of the passage then of reflection, Deuteronomy chapter 4, verses 32 to 35, where it says, search to the ends of the earth, in fact, even search out the heavens to see if there is ever a time when a God has performed miracles such as these, which God performed for us. And it also, I'm going to suggest, recalls the intriguing text regarding the future redemption. By the way, redemption often gets lost in the saying of it. Redemption. Liberation and restoration is what we're talking about. Anyhow, in that future liberation and restoration, as the prophet says, Micah chapter 7, verse 15, like the days you left Egypt, so what we saw in these texts, like the days you left Egypt, I will show you great miracles. But think about that for a second. This does not make sense. The previous parsha last week ends with, as it was, well, no, we didn't read that part of it, but it ends just a paragraph after what was read to you. And Pharaoh saw the rain, the hail, and the thunder, saw that it had stopped. And he still continued to sin, many English translations have it, and hardened his heart. Steeled his resolve is a better way of putting it. Oh, and by the way, please note that that occurs before the text, the parsha for this week, which was read to you and which I read as well. God hardened Pharaoh's heart. God didn't do anything until Pharaoh had done it half a dozen times before. So God just confirmed what Pharaoh had already done. And as the closing parsha from the closing portion of the parsha from last week reminds us, Pharaoh continued still to sin and steeled his resolve. Now notice then, and this is important, I'll get back to this shortly. The miracles had no effect. The miracles had no effect. So why did God make all these wonders happen for nothing, we should then ask. And what is this supposed to teach us about liberation, past and future, future being what the Micah passage says? Not only that, why did he make so many miracles? I mean, if he merely wanted to free the Jews, why didn't he just fly them to Israel in LL? Or just make the Egyptians simply disappear? Well, our parsha provides us with a hint. Again, Ve'et ototai asher samtivam vidatem ki ani Adonai. And the signs which I put among them, I did so that they would know they would come to know that I am the Lord. This is in stark contrast with what we read from Pharaoh's mouth a few chapters earlier, chapter 5 and verse 2, where Pharaoh says when Moses first approached him a couple weeks ago, I'm in the reading from a couple weeks ago. He didn't approach Pharaoh a couple weeks ago. All right. He says, who is the Lord that I should obey him? Catch the emphasis? He considers himself God, and so he says, who's this other thing that I should obey him? Well, therefore, the text says, hit alalti lemitzrayim. Again, often translated, performed. And I said there's an alternate translation that conveys the meaning that underlies this. And a number of our great Jewish commentators, including Rashi, pointed this out. I made a mockery of them. I made a mockery of them. And what they stood for and what they believed. Now remember, prior to this week's parsha, seven plagues have already been sent on Pharaoh and on his people, with each plague rendering a different Egyptian god and element of society helpless. And that's important to remember. We still see the unrelenting Pharaoh continue to defy God's order to let his people go. So in tonight's text, we see God unravel the great illusion of Pharaoh as God, and break through the arrogance of a leader whose kingdom was, to borrow a phrase from another interesting story, whose kingdom was simply built on the sand. And in the reality, please remember that in Egypt it is literally built on the sand as well. Come on, stick with me, gang. And so our text hints at that tonight. Now the first four plagues had come in quick succession. God had polluted the Nile with blood through Aaron's rod, choking off life and discrediting Hapi, the god of the Nile. God then, as you remember the plagues, makes frogs swarm over the entire Nile and all over the land, leaving the Egyptians with the croaking reminder. Thank you for sticking with me on that one. That the Egyptian god Hecht does not control fertility. The God of Israel does. God then infests the land with swarms of lice, most likely feeding on the rotting fish and the dead frogs who had croaked. And then the lice are then followed by swarms of insects who carry deadly viruses. And then Pharaoh finally seems to relent and he offers to free the Jews. So God mercifully holds back the plagues. But Pharaoh at heart is still stubborn, so he refuses to let God's people go. So God sends mysterious disease against the livestock. Then God commands Moses to throw handfuls of soot into the air, and this soot, as it falls, brings boils on the skin of all Egyptians who come in contact with it. Egypt is consequently revealed as a festering land of disease and pollution. And it carries with it the implication that Pharaoh has lost control of his empire. Now it's an empire of death. The Nile, the source of Egypt's life, is dead. The livestock are decimated. The people are infected with mysterious diseases. And Pharaoh, the one who's supposed to be the lord of it all, or over all of Egypt, cannot do a thing to stop it. Then there's the seventh plague, hail. The plague in which it seems as if the sky itself falls down. And God commands Moses then to present himself before Pharaoh. And he says, in the text that was read to you, here's what the Lord says, the God of Israel. Let my people go so that they may worship me. Hold on to that thought for a minute. This time, I will send all my plagues on you yourself and on your officials and on your people so that you may know that there is no one like me in all the earth. Does that sound familiar? We often sing it. Ein kamocha, ve'elim Adonai. There is no one like you O Lord, among the gods in all the earth. And then back to the text. For by now I could have stretched out my hand and struck you and your people with disease, and you would have been cut off from the earth. But this is why I have let you live, to show you my power and to make my name resound. Remember, name has to do with reputation. So to make my reputation resound through all the earth. Yet, you are still exalting yourself against and over my people and will not let them go. So the text says. But even the hail does not convince Pharaoh. And so we read at the end of the chapter, the last part of the parsha from last week. He continued to sin, and he steeled his resolve. Therefore, along come the locusts in the darkness, our parsha for this week. Here God addresses Moses with the command, bow, which, as I pointed out, means come. And so we gain an insight, perhaps, into God and his ways, because rather than saying go, he said come. What? Come? It's a picture, it's an indicator that God is the power, picture this, behind and beyond Pharaoh. And Pharaoh is in God's control. So through the first seven plagues, God guided a process of removing little by little the grandeur that Pharaoh and all his predecessors had erected for themselves. And then finally, the master illusion of Pharaoh's God image is starting to slip away. And as promised, we have chapter 7 and verse 1, where God says, I will make you like God to Pharaoh. In other words, pointing out that he is not God. And so the influence and fear that Pharaoh was able to wield has finally vanished under the darkness of the ninth plague. And the chief god of Egypt, Ra, the sun god, is seen to have expired. And just what had Pharaoh learned from all these plagues and signs that God had brought on him? Well, perhaps he learned something like this. Nothing is foolproof to a sufficiently determined fool. Yep. Atheism, now hear me carefully, is a non-profit, P-H-E-T, organization. I have to wait till some of you catch up with it. He may have learned that death is life's way of telling you, you've been fired. Well, he hadn't learned that yet, but he certainly was about to. Now, there's a very interesting hint in the instructions regarding that tenth plague that are found in chapter 12. The lamb, by the way, the lamb is a picture of another Egyptian god. The lamb is killed on the 14th of Nisan and then eaten that evening. So what? Well, remember, darkness had obliterated the sun over Egypt. The evening of the 14th and 15th of Nisan was the night of the full moon, indicating that the God of Israel had clearly triumphed over the gods of Egypt. But there's still more to our story. Our section, with all its plagues, also alerts us that people are not ultimately affected in a permanent or deep way by miracles. After all, remember, Moses ended up doing 10 of them, and they had no lasting results on either Egypt or on Pharaoh, for two reasons. Miracles are temporary. As soon as the miracle stops, so does its effects, as it did with Pharaoh. And two, they are impersonal. They may amaze you, but they rarely transform you. But in the future liberation, it will be different. Remember the text from Micah 7:15 that I mentioned earlier on. Like the days you left Egypt, I will show you great miracles. And then the miracles will be constant. The world will be filled with the knowledge of God at that time. And also, they will affect each person. Malachi 4, in the opening paragraph, reminded us of this with a different kind of picture. And again, providing light into darkness. He says, the sun of righteousness, that's spelled S-U-N, the sun of righteousness will rise with healing in its wings. And so everyone will know, will truly and personally know God. By the way, this gives us further insight into the plagues. As we've seen, all 10 signs were meant to discredit the false gods of Egypt and Pharaoh's false claim to govern creation. On the positive side, these miracles, these plagues, these signs, as they are called, were meant to convince all of Egypt that the God of Israel really existed, that God had a special covenant relationship with the children of Israel, and that God and God alone is the creator and king over all. So we learn that the 10 signs, and they are called signs, that God brought upon Egypt were both punitive and redemptive. By punishing Egypt for their transgression, God gave them the opportunity to turn from their transgressions and be spared like he had spared Nineveh. Even further, before that. And by the way, remember some did, like Nineveh, respond. Because when they left Egypt, it was a mixed multitude. There were Egyptians that were among them, we're told. Even further, according to Deuteronomy chapter 18, verse 18, God said he would raise up a prophet like Moses from Israel to be their final liberator, like Moses. But what made Moses unique as a prophet? Well, the Torah tells us that the key aspect was, as the Torah itself closes at the end of Deuteronomy, all these miraculous signs and wonders God sent him to do in Egypt. And given that as a background, it therefore only makes sense that the first sign, the first mosaic-like sign that Yeshua performed, involved the transformation of water into wine at the wedding in Cana. What was the first sign Moses produced? The water was turned red with blood. And here Yeshua turns water into what is often called the blood of grapes wine. Oh, by the way, the rest of John picks up on this theme, but that's another story. In fact, it's a whole course. And that was a commercial, in case you were wondering. But then, strangely, tacked on at the end of this week's parsha, seemingly as an afterthought, and almost out of nowhere, is the commandment regarding tefillin, the phylacteries, to serve, as the text says, as a sign on your hand and as a remembrance between your eyes. Sign. There's that same term as for the miracles, and there's the connector. Further, tefillin are referred to, like I said, as a sign, as something special, and in fact reminds us of the miraculous. So then it raises the question, so what's the connection between tefillin and the previous sections of the parasha dealing with Israel's liberation? Well, the Exodus passages where tefillin are listed center on the theme of liberation, whereas the related passages in Deuteronomy, the related tefillin passages, focus on following God's will, what we call the mitzvot, the behaviors that are in keeping with his guidelines. Now, these distinct purposes for tefillin express a major theme that's found throughout the whole Torah. And in fact, because of the tefillin passages here, is reiterated for us at this point, as the story concludes for this week. The children of Israel are liberated from slavery, Hebrews, avodah, from slavery to Pharaoh, only to serve, same term, avodah, to serve God through the keeping of the mitzvot, the behaviors in keeping with his guidelines. Oh, by the way, avodah also has another meaning, worship. Quick aside, stepping out of the story. If you have trouble from time to time during services, because it seems like you're putting a lot of effort into it, remember, worship is avodah, work. And it's worth the work. It's worth the effort to do the work. Okay, back to this story. Where was I? Oh, tefillin. There's a connection then between liberation and God's guidelines and living them out. So our liberation is also inextricably connected to our service to God through the keeping of the mitzvot, living lives in accordance with his guidelines. And the tefillin at the end of our parsha reminds us of this vital connection. In other words, as the rabbi said in Romans chapter 6, God set us free so we can freely serve him, our God, the God of and over all creation. He set you free so you can choose to serve. Take the next minute or so in quiet reflection to renew that choice and that commitment.